What I want to read to you is my contribution to the newspaper that I wrote, and I'll explain to you, you know, why I wrote it. I wrote, the OCC, the Oceanic Cleanup Crew, which was established shortly after the return of Christ some 20 years ago, is pleased to announce that this week its function of cleaning up the oceans of debris, sunken ships, and huge slugs floating around the ocean composed of plastic bottles, syringes, nylon nets, and other paraphernalia which the prior age had polluted the oceans with has been completed. The shorelines on the continents have been cleaned up of any debris washed ashore also. Shortly after the OCC was established under the auspices of the branch of government responsible for the nations with men like Moses, Abraham, and Joseph in positions of responsibility, the OCC built a huge 1,500-foot, totally pollution-free vessel with capabilities of lifting sunken vessels and ships laying on the bottom of the ocean from previous wars, also from the destruction of the Great Tribulation, and raise them up. Using developed methods of buoyancy and hydraulics, these sunken ships were able to actually be brought up into the hull of the OCC ship named Starfish and be totally dismantled and recycled for peaceful use. The backup ships and barges for transporting materials back to the mainland for reuse were also utilized in this massive project, which included 700,000 square foot barges and a fleet of 24 smaller vessels for shoreline cleanup and recycling. Any ships which had been using nuclear fusion for propulsion were able to be safely neutralized on the material used for safe, peaceful purposes. The ships were cut up using new techniques of cutting steel with extremely high water pressure, and the material sent to foundries for the steel and aluminum and other materials to be recycled into farm implements, plows, and tractors. Other materials were able to be recycled also. We were able to raise and recycle ships such as the Titanic, the Lusitania, and other warships sunk during the three world wars the world had gone through from the past. At a ceremony in Jerusalem, Christ congratulated the captain and crew and also the members of the support team of ships and barges used to complete this project. The Starfish and other smaller vessels used for the operation were also dismantled, and the material used for recycling and recycled for peaceful purposes. The men involved in this project will now be employed in peaceful and useful manufacturing of farming implements. This was a joyful occasion since the shores and oceans are now completely pollution-free from the abuse and pollution from man from the previous ages. This report was submitted by Captain Charles J. Taylor of the OCC Mothership Starfish. Now, the whole purpose of these of the newspaper was to bring out articles that projected, you know, 20 years down into the future. And what kind of triggered me to write this article was I was watching a program on TV, and it was the Cousteau, Jacques Cousteau's son, and they were traveling on the Hawaiian Islands north of the main islands, which are prohibited by normal people to attend there, and most of them are just occupied by scientific teams. In fact, one island was only occupied by a single woman, and they're off bounds for people. But what I found truly amazing about this documentary I was watching was that the shoreline on these islands was, you know, fishnets. Nylon fishnets had been washed ashore, and in syringes and plastic bottles and all kinds of paraphernalia. And, of course, it had a very negative impact on the wildlife there. I mean, they were swallowing these things, and it affected their physical being, and it affected, you know, the eggs they were laying. It was just a real shocking discovery. And, I mean, how the shores could be strewn with all this stuff. And, of course, you know, a plastic bottle has a life of, what, 1,000 years? And a nylon net just doesn't dissolve in salt water. So unless these problems are dealt with, they're not going to be, you know, they're going to be around for a long time. The pollution of the ocean is one of several challenges we will have to deal with at the onset of the millennium. And into the millennium, since it will take years to correct. It's not going to be done overnight. And today I would like to look at the problems and some possible solutions. So what the title of my sermon today is the challenges in the millennium. When you consider conditions of the earth at the onset of the millennium, it's not something you can just wish away. It has to be dealt with. Consider that I just mentioned plastic containers have a 1,000-year life, and it's irresponsible just to leave that in the oceans. So my first point on this is the oceans and rivers. When I was younger, there was a newest ministry not far from where I lived. There was a penitentiary there, and at the base of this penitentiary, there was a river there called the Fraser River, and the Fraser River went into the Pacific Ocean. There was a huge culvert that dumped into the Fraser River. We used to go down there as kids, and this thing was, I would say, 20 feet in diameter, and it was just raw sewage coming straight out of this pipe into the river. And it was a really great spot to catch sturgeon because they're bottom feeders. And I mean, I wouldn't, you know, at that time, I don't think anybody ate those things because of where they were catching them. But I mean, it was just appalling that, you know, you'd see this stuff floating down, of course, into the river and then into the ocean, which is only several miles away. And you can see all kinds of stuff floating out of this paraphernalia, floating out of this culvert. Also, a few miles from where I lived, there was a packing house, a slaughterhouse, we called it a packing house, which was built over a creek, which flowed into the Fraser River. And they had horrendous practices in them days. All they did when they slaughtered the animals, you know, they had a cement floor, and they had a hole in the floor. And, of course, all the innards went into the hole in the floor. They'd wash it down, the blood and everything, into this creek. And you drive, there was a little bridge there, and I remember you drive over this bridge, and the stench, it was horrible. And, of course, the creek went into the river, and the river's close to the ocean, so it was affected by the tides. And at low tides, the smell, you could hardly bear it. That's how bad it was. And, you know, practices like that, of course, the place was shut down. It just wouldn't be allowed in the world tomorrow. Years ago, the Plain Truth magazine showed a river in the States that had signs up, like, no smoking because it would catch fire. That's how bad the pollution was in it. Unbelievable as it sounds. And the pollution in the Rhine River is high because of all, it flows through several countries, and all the heavy industrial waste are poured into this river. And I'll just read you here about the pollution in the Rhine River. As long as people have lived near the Rhine, they have thrown their refuse into the water. In the past, the river was usually able to clean itself and break down pollutants. However, since the Industrial Revolution, the volume of waste has risen greatly, and the type of waste changed. Today, industrial effluents mixed with domestic waste, sewage, phosphates, and heavy metals like lead and mercury, not all these pollutants are biodegradable, and some are highly toxic into the river. Many types of industries have established themselves along the banks of the rivers. The chemical industry disposes of waste containing heavy metals such as cadmium, lead, and mercury. The paper making, brewing, and the detergents industry also dump their waste into the river. Although most of these emissions are properly authorized, some emissions are not, and there is always the risk of accidental spills or leaks. Households dispose of a variety of waste products, soap, detergents, leftovers, and sewage. People often throw things directly into the river, from pieces of paper to rusting bed frames and old bicycles. Many agricultural practices lead to organic waste, chemical fertilizers, and other waste products reaching the river. Fertilizers containing various chemicals from phosphates, nitrates, to poisonous hydrocarbons. So this is all dumped, into the Rhine. And of course, the Rhine flows into the ocean and it pollutes the ocean. I watched a program on TV several years ago about the Colorado River. There was companies along Colorado River, not the Colorado, the Rio Grande, I'm sorry, in Texas. And because of they were tightening up on some of these regulations as far as what can be dumped into the river, all the companies did, they moved into Mexico because the river flows into Mexico. Well, in Mexico, no regulations, no rules, so they were just dumping their chemical waste into the river, and then they showed, you know, people in Mexico were poor and some of them were living along the water. Well, the kids, you know, they had, you know, hair falling off and horrendous sores in their body, all from these pollutants, all for the sake of, you know, greed, man's greed, you know, polluting the river because they can get away with it there. So although, you know, we've made steps forward in Canada and the United States as far as, you know, trying to limit the pollutions into the rivers and oceans, I mean, there are countries that just don't have regulations, and frankly, they don't care. They're only concerned about the bottom line, and that's, you know, the almighty dollar. And it's just, it's really sad. When I was working, before I came into the church, I was doing a job. You've heard of Dow Chemical. It's a pretty big company. Well, I was working with a bricklayer on this site, and I mean, these guys are wearing masks. I mean, the air, I mean, it was, you know, it would almost choke you from the chemicals in the air just at the plant. And we were working there, and I looked at the back, and they had a big area, probably the size of a football field, with plywood all around, and it had about a 4-inch pipe, and it was spewing out this black gunk. I mean, it just reams of it, you know, piles, filling up this whole thing. So I asked one of the workers there, I says, what is that stuff? And the smell coming off it, I mean, it almost choked you. And he said, well, it's a byproduct of some of the stuff we're making. And I says, well, why are you putting it in the back there like that? He says, well, we figure there's some use for it. We just haven't figured it out yet. I mean, in the meantime, you know, the odor coming off it, you don't know what it's doing to the ground. They didn't protect the ground and the atmosphere. But here again, you know, they figured we could make some money out of it, so we'll just put it there. Do you know where the biggest landfill of the world is? Can any of you guess? The biggest landfill in the world. I'll read it to you. The largest landfill on Earth, the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. You can call it the plastic soup. I bet you haven't heard about the world's largest junkyard, also rather infamously known as the Pacific Trash Vortex. The world's largest landfill is located in the northern Pacific Ocean in an area of slow-moving sea currents called the North Pacific Subtropical Gyre. It is oceanic desert. Its denizens, man, phytoplanktons, I'm sorry, but scarce other marine life. Far away from the world's shipping lanes, the chief flora is the massive mass of floating debris. The size of this mass, believe it or not, is equivalent to the continent of the United States. Yeah, I know. Most people aren't even aware of this. This huge garbage island actually is two different but linked areas, the eastern garbage patch and is located between California and it's the size of Texas, and the other garbage patch spreads from east of Japan to westward. It's a small print. I'm having trouble reading at that particular part. The patches are connected by a thin 6,000-mile-long current along the subtropical convergence zone. The patches are a mess of debris, junk, human and otherwise, collected from all corners, from discarded electronics to children's toys. It is a profusion of waste. The chief concentration, though, is, as usual, plastic, abundant, and unbiodegradables, which plastics are, you know. Cost to the environment and us. studies show that concentration of plastic in reality, 1 million pieces of plastic per square mile. Earlier, non-polymorous debris used to biodegrade, but with increasing consumption of plastic around the world, the substance has taken over the entire mass. The plastics, though, do photodegrade rather slowly, and even with slow photodegeneration, the plastics are now breaking into other forms of pollutants. As plastics get fragmented, called nurdles, they are ingested by jellyfish and other marine fauna. Toxicity from such plastic pollutants seeps into the ocean water and thus into the food chain. I mean, and this thing is the size of the United States, right? And here's a little food for thought. A study of the black-footed albatross in Midway Islands off the East Coast garbage patch revealed that of the 500,000 chicks born every year, 200,000 of them die, many of them from choking on plastics fed to them by their parents who mistake it for food. I mean, and this is the reality of the situation today. Is there a solution? Experts say the idea of thralling the ocean for thrash is physically not viable. The garbage is not only expansive in area and content, but is also dispersed into smaller areas submerged and floating hundreds of feet below the surface. Trawling over such a vast area would also harm the endemic marine ecosystem. The solution is long-term and involves the usual global exhortations regarding management of this future waste. It's back to square one. So in other words, there's this huge, massive, you know, garbage floating around there. It's affecting wildlife and the ocean, and they talk about it. They're like, well, we've got to deal with this, but nothing is ever done. It's pretty astonishing. And pollution is only one of the problems. The others are shipwrecks and sunken ships and their payloads. Here's another eye-opener for you. How many total sunken ships are there in the oceans around the world? Ever thought of that? The Great Lakes are the largest repositories of shipwrecks anywhere in the world. 6,000 to 10,000 shipwrecks have been discovered so far just in the Great Lakes. Worldwide is unknown. There are estimates. Shipwreck is the remains of a ship that has wrecked, it having either been sunk or beached. A shipwreck can refer to a wrecked ship or to the event that caused the wreck, such as the striking of something that causes a ship to sink, the standing of a ship on rocks such as a shoal, or the destruction of a ship by sea by violent weather. Whatever the cause of sunken ship or wrecked ship is a physical example of the event. Now here's the real eye-opener. There are more than 3 million shipwrecks on the ocean floor, the United Nations estimates. 3 million, that's today. 3 million shipwrecks. I want you to turn over to Revelation 8. In Revelation 8, and beginning in verse 8, Revelation 8:8, it says, "Then the second angel sounded, and something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea, and a third of the sea became blood, and a third of the living creatures of the sea died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. Then the third angel sounded, a great star fell from heaven, burning like a torch, and it fell on a third of the rivers and on the springs of water. The name of the star is Wormwood. A third of the waters became wormwood, and many men died from the water because it was made bitter. One third of the ships destroyed as a result." So I went online and I thought, okay, we've got 3 million wrecks in the ocean today. How many ships are there? There are 55,054 merchant ships today. That's not including warships and private craft. This is strictly merchant ships. 30% of those is 18,350, which are going to be destroyed when these things happen in Revelation. Now, that does not include warships, submarines, or personal pleasure craft. There are 2,898 warships. So a third of those being destroyed is 869. So you're looking at 3.3 million, perhaps, things to deal with in the ocean floor at the onset of the millennium. Bit of a challenge, don't you think? So that's the reality of the situation today. And it could even be higher than that because, I mean, throughout the tribulation, we know there's going to be wars and things going back and forth. So this is an enormous task. And I just want to, I read in my article about, you know, the technology used to deal with this problem. I just want to read you some of the new technology that we have available today. And one is, I was saying about high-pressure water jets for using for cutting steel, which is basically a pollution-free way of cutting it. A water jet tool is used in machine shops to cut metal parts with very high-pressure streams of water. As amazing as it sounds, you can get water flowing fast enough to actually cut metal. Now, it has its limitations, obviously, you know, but it can cut metal. Think of a water jet as something about 30 times the pressure of the power washer wand in your local car wash. The power washing car wash is an everyday example of a dirt film being cut off the body, wheels, and tires of an automobile. The key to cutting metal with water is to keep the spray coherent. Water jets are able to cut because the spray is channeled through a very narrow jeweled nozzle at a very high pressure to keep the spray coherent. Unlike metal cutters, a water jet never gets dull and it cannot overheat. So it has quite, you know, some nice advantages. Low-pressure water jets were first used for mining gold in California in 1852. Steam and hot water jets were used in the early 1900s for cleaning. High-pressure water jets were used for mining in the 1960s. And about 10 years ago, industry began using water jets for cutting. Abrasive water jets were used first in the industry at about 1980. In the past, only one piece of metal could be cut at a time with a saw or other metal cutting mechanical process. It was time-intensive and expensive. Computer-controlled water jet and abrasive jet cutting are used today in industry to cut many soft and hard metals. This plain water abrasive mixture leaves the nozzle at more than 900 miles per hour. The latest machines can cut to within 2/1000ths of an inch and have jet speeds of Mach 3. So that's the speed of the water coming out, which is what, 2,000 miles an hour? A water jet can cut a sandwich of different materials up to 4 inches thick. So, you know, 4 inches thick with water. The odorless, dust-free, and relatively heat-free process can also cut something as thin as 5/1000ths of an inch. The tiny jet stream permits the first cut to be used to be the final finished surface. This single cutting process saves material costs, machine costs, for example, and engineering merely gives a drawing to the cutting shop via diskette or email and gets the finished work back. Water jets cut softer materials while abrasive jets are used for harder materials. The actual cutting is often done underwater to reduce splash and noise. Faster feed relates to use to prevent the jet from cutting all the way through. The water pressure is typically 20,000 to 55,000 pounds per square inch. It's almost unbelievable. The water is forced through a 0.01 diameter hole, which is a jewel. A water jet can remove the bark from a tree at a distance of 40 feet if one alters the chemistry of plain water by adding super water, available from Berkeley Chemical Research. But this is just one of the technologies that can be used when we start, when the, you know, ships have to be dismantled. Now, I emailed Terry Gray because he's a welder, and because I was thinking, you know, what's the limitations of a cutting torch? I mean, I've used them in the past, but you're cutting very thin metal. And I says, what's the thickest you can cut steel with a cutting torch? And he said, well, if you go very slow, you probably an inch thick of steel. And he says, and if you go slow, maybe even a little thicker. Well, when I was still working, I had a co-worker, and he took an oxygen acetylene torch, and he modified it, and using natural gas, which would be totally pollutant-free, he could cut a 6-inch piece of steel. And I'm not kidding you, the cut was as smooth as if it was cut a knife through butter. Like a cutting torch, even if you put an edge there, it always leaves little ridges. You know, you put an edge beside where you cut the metal, it leaves little ridges. This torch, the surface was as smooth as a side, and you can cut through 6 inches. And what really bugs me is this guy was an Englishman. That really annoyed me, you know. Should have been a Frenchman. But he has so much talent, this Englishman. I mean, he could do anything with metal. I mean, he could build stuff, but he came up with this. And, I mean, that's... if man puts their mind to it, they can come up with all kinds of things to help, you know, deal with this problem. Because one of the biggest problems is going to be dismantling and taking, you know, the ships apart and that. So how will this cleanups of the oceans be actually accomplished, eh? For one thing, I think by the time Christ returns, there won't be much industry because of everything that's going on. And the plants and foundries that are required to start up, they're just not going to be allowed to pollute the rivers and the oceans. That's not going to be allowed. So right away, you're going to help the problem because you're not, you know, adding to it. It's amazing the healing powers of the ocean if we just stop polluting it. Yeah, as far as the oceans are concerned, you can't leave ships, you know, in the ocean. Like 3 million pieces of junk in the ocean, you just can't do that. That has to be cleaned up. I mean, you don't have a child make a big mess in a room and then just close the door and pretend it doesn't exist. I mean, you got metals down there, you got corrosives in the ocean. There's going to be ships down there with atomic warheads. I mean, you could just say, well, we'll just stop polluting the oceans and we'll just leave everything alone. And you know how corrosive salt water is. And you're out there fishing with your son in the millennium, and all of a sudden you hear this big roar, and out comes this ICBM out of the ocean, and because some ship little fish bit on the wires and fired it off. It's, oh, maybe we should have dealt with that. You know, it's heading right towards town. I mean, you can't do that. You have radioactive materials. You have warships. They have to be dealt with. They need to be neutralized and dismantled and cleaned up. Reused. That huge landfill the size of the United States has to be dealt with. The stuff has to be removed and recycled. No more raw sewage in the ocean. Some treatment plants, if they're done right, really, you know, a sewage treatment plant, if everything's done right, the water at the end should be as good as the water off the tap at home. Mind you, most people would be, I'm not going to do that, but it's a very effective way to, you know, to deal with it, with sewage, that is. You don't dump it in the ocean, you just treat it and you can process it so that the water is suitable for drinking at the end. I'd like to turn to Revelation 8. Revelation 8:8. I think I read this, but I just want to bring out a point. It says, the second angel sounded, and something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea, and a third of the sea became blood. And a third of the living creatures in the sea died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. Now, sea animals, they cannot live in blood. So how is this problem going to be solved? I mean, you know, you got oceans full of blood. You know, so actually, God has worked out some of the solutions to some of these problems, but we're going to be responsible for fixing a lot of them. Would you turn over to Ezekiel chapter 47? And we'll read some of the things that God says in Ezekiel. In Ezekiel chapter 47, And we'll begin in verse 1. It says, "Then he brought me back to the door of the temple, and there was a water flowing from under the threshold of the temple towards the east, for the front of the temple faced the east, and the water was flowing under the right side of the temple, south of the altar. He brought me by way of the north gate and led me around the outside to the outer gate that faces east, and there was water running out on the right side. And when the man went out to the east," this is going east from Jerusalem, be towards Jordan, with the line in his hand, he measured 1,000 cubits, which is what? 1,800 feet. And he brought me through the water, and the water came up to my ankles. So 1,800 feet out is only about 3 inches deep. And again, he measured 1,000 and brought me through the water, and the water came up to my knees. So double the distance now, it's like six times the depth of the water. And again, he measured 1,000 and he brought me through the water, and the water came up to his waist. So the further he's getting away from the source, the deeper the water is. And in verse 5, "Again he measured 1,000, it was a river, and I could not cross, for the river was too deep, water in which one must swim, a river that cannot be crossed. And he said to me, 'Son of man, have you seen this?' Then he brought me to and returned me to the bank of the river. When I returned, there along the bank of the river were many trees on each side and the other." And in verse 8, "Then he said to me, 'This water flows towards the eastern region, goes down into the valley and enters the sea. Where it reaches the sea, its waters are healed. And it shall be that every living thing that moves wherever the river goes will live. There will be a great multitude of fish because of these waters go there. They will be healed, and everything will live wherever the river goes." So here is a God, you know, is recreating obviously the fish that have died. But the waters, as this river flows into the sea and expands, it's healing them. But here again, you know, that's great. The oceans will be pristine, clean, and the rivers will be clean, and we'll have good, clean water. But there are limitations to this because it doesn't get rid of the plastic and the steel and the aluminum and the wire and all the stuff in the oceans. That's what we have to get rid of. And then this whole complete healing process will be a one finished product. God has a plan to replenish the fish, the animals that have died, and also to clean up the waters and make them pristine clean as far as the pollutants are concerned. But God's children will have to develop, and that's us, you and me, will have to develop methods of removing the physical material from such as ships and wood and plastics and other material in the oceans and recycle them for peaceful uses. That's one of the challenges in the world tomorrow in regards to rivers and oceans. The other challenge is the land. Obviously, one of the first things that has to be done is to bury the dead. I mean, you just can't have millions of dead bodies laying around on the earth. You know, one of the worst things for passing on disease. And they'll be in the millions, and it will take some 7 months to accomplish. Go over to Ezekiel 39. I mean, here again, it's a land cleansing now we're dealing with. Ezekiel 39 and verse 11, it says, "It will come to pass in that day that I will give Gog a burial place there in Israel, the valley of those who pass by east to the sea, and it will obstruct travelers because there will be they will bury Gog and all its multitude. Therefore, they will call it the valley of Hamon Gog. For 7 months, the house of Israel will be burying them in order to cleanse land." So one of the biggest tasks we're going to have is, you know, dealing with the bodies, get rid of them. And then, of course, it's dealing with the cities. Because, you know, look how long it took to clean up two buildings that fell in New York, you know. It took years, probably 6 or 7 years just to get rid of those two towers that fell in New York, because you've got concrete and, you know, steel and stuff. It all has to be cleaned up. Go over to Revelation 16, please. In Revelation 16. In In Revelation 16 and verse 17, it says, "Then the seventh angel poured out his bowl into the air, and a loud voice came out of the temple of heaven from the throne, saying, 'It is done.' And there were noises and thunderings and lightnings, and there was a great earthquake, such a mighty and great earthquake as had not occurred since men were on the earth. Now the great city was divided into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell, and great Babylon was remembered before God to give her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath." Now, you know how long it took to clean up the Twin Towers? No, we're talking about the cities of the world falling. I mean, none of this 100-story high-rise apartments, that's not going to be the way things are done in the millennium. But all these cities, and of course, here again, you're going to have to deal with, when the cities are cleaned up, you're going to have to deal with the bodies that you come across. There's going to be dead bodies in there too. But I mean, that's an enormous project to clean up the land, you know, taking care of these cities and recycling the stuff and the material. Go over to Amos 9. In Amos 9 and verse 13, it says, "Behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, when the plowman shall overtake the reaper, and the treader of grapes him who sows the seed. The mountains shall drip sweet wine, and all the hills will flow from it. I will bring back the captives of my people Israel. They shall build the waste cities and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and drink wine from them. They shall also make gardens and eat fruits from them." So, how big is this task? The total number of cities in the world, 36,722. How long do you suppose it will take to clean up the rubble, recycle the concrete, the blacktop, steel, wire, aluminum? You know, and it's amazing what they can do today. I saw a program on TV. You know, there's a program called Monstrous Machines. You know, they show these big trucks and that. And this guy invented, it was a huge drum. I mean, a big round thing. And inside it had a big shaft, and it had arms on it with really hard knobs on the end. And he could literally throw a big bus in there, and this thing would crunch, 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 grind, grind, grind. And on the bottom, he had about a foot opening and a conveyor belt. And it was just, you know, pieces of metal about this big would come out from the bus, and it would go along, and then they'd separate the metal from the other parts. But I mean, you know, that's today. I mean, you know, it's amazing what they have. And of course, the cities have to be rebuilt, so they're going to have to be cleaned up and recycled. And of course, too, you know, you got to think of this. Even the rebuilding process, you know, today thing has built-in obsolescence, right? Because they don't want to sell you a product that's going to last you forever. They want to sell you a product that's going to break down in 6 months, so you go buy another product, and then 6 months later, another one. Or the technology, you know, as soon as you buy your computer, the next day it's obsolete because, you know, they've got a bigger, faster chip in it. And that's how the economy works today. But, you know, we're going to have to build stuff to last 1,000 years. So, you know, the materials, whether or not they're, you know, man-made or, you know, brick or stone and a combination of wood, it's going to have to last, not just some of the junk we see today. And when we build the cities, you still have needs, like, and as far as manufacturing of goods required for the people. And, you know, if you're responsible for a city, it has to be a blend of housing and parks and industry. Beautiful fountains, like the Ambassador Auditorium was a beautiful building with the fountains in the front and the water. Buildings like that. And they have to be a safe place. I mean, one has to be, you know, safe or feel safe. I remember years ago, I mean, I went to Pasadena. We were down there, and we had to stay with a couple's place a little bit north of where the auditorium was. So we're there, and you know, we met the woman. I can't remember her name. So I look at her door, and, you know, she had about six locks, you know, bolt lock, this and that, and chain and that. And I says, well, why do you need all that? She says, oh, this is not a very safe area. A lot of homes get broken into. I mean, you know. I thought, well, that's not living. You're a prisoner in your own house. And one of the most comforting scriptures that I've read in regards to this is found in Zechariah 8. I'd like you to turn there with me. In Zechariah 8 and verse 4, it says, thus says the Lord of hosts, old men and old women shall again sit in the streets of Jerusalem, each one with his staff in his hand because of his great age. The streets of the city shall be full of boys and girls playing in the streets. Every city rebuilt will be safe for children to play in the streets. I mean, you almost need an armed guard sometimes to, you know, send your kids to the school bus in some areas. But that's going to be history. It'll be, the cities will be safe places for children. And I mean, there's nothing, well, I know Mr. Harris does too, you know, watching the grandchildren play. And, you know, at my place, there's nothing I enjoy more than watching my grandchildren play in the backyard. We have a nice yard, and we've got few ducks and chickens, and we got a teeter-totter and a swing and a trampoline and a swimming pool, and just watching them play, I mean, it just brings so much joy to you. But, you know, they do it safely, and not every home can do that, but that fear is going to be gone. And another problem I've just got written down here is types of energy for housing. Housing itself have to be built to last for a long time. Now, how's it going to be accomplished? I don't know. I mean, even today you have underground wiring, get rid of posts, and, you know, it beautifies. I can't see telephone posts and wires hanging from them. I just can't envision that. But, I mean, you could have homes with, you know, all solar panels. I mean, you know. If you can get men underground in a laboratory, you know, building a germ that's going to kill a million people, and that's, you know, that's his pet project. I mean, the guy's got brains, but put his talents into developing a process where you can energize a home for next to nothing, pollution-free, and cars. I mean, you know, it can be done. I mean, instead of figuring out how to get a man to the moon, figure out how we're going to solve this problem about polluting on the earth. Some of you may remember the large digester. You remember that, Mr. Harris, at Big Sandy. I don't know if some of you heard of this, but I went on the internet, because when I was thinking about this sermon, I was thinking, wait a minute, they used to have that big, huge digester. So I went on the internet and I found some information. This is quite interesting, and this was when the campus was running. This is what I found. It says, on the campus there was a unique contraption. It was called the digester. It was designed in Sweden, built there, and the Worldwide Church of God paid to have it shipped from Stockholm to Big Sandy. The concept was original, and it worked. The 60-foot metal cylinder was about 15 feet in diameter, so that's twice the height of this room in diameter, and 60 feet long, so longer than the end of the room. It had three internal compartments and was mounted on about a 5-degree angle and rotated at approximately one rev per hour. Garbage, no cloth or metal, was fed into the top compartment. Digestive enzymes were introduced, and this garbage was left to ferment for a week. At the end of that time, the top inner compartment was opened, and the garbage fell into a second middle chamber. New garbage was now fed into the top chamber. At the end of the second week, the last and lowest inner chamber was opened to receive the pulverized garbage from the second chamber, and the second chamber now received what was fermenting on the top chamber. More garbage was then poured into the empty top compartment. At the end of 3 weeks, the lowest chamber was opened and the contents recovered for soil distribution. By now, this substance was reduced to soil clay substance with no smell, and provided perfect organic topsoil that allowed the abundant growth of new fruits and vegetables. I mean, this was when the Big Sandy campus was operating. The above procedure was repeated for all new garbage coming in. Not only did Big Sandy get rid of their garbage this way, but the whole town of Gladwater, population 7,500 in those days, used the digester as well. All free, of course. So you can see that there are ways that you can develop to recycle garbage and other things, you know, and then have them for useful purposes. I was thinking, you know, you've got this, you're responsible for a town, right? And of course, people have got to eat. So what you have is you have the slaughterhouse on the outskirts of town, right? And then attached to the slaughterhouse, well, you have, you know, a meat store, obviously, you know, selling meats. And then you have a leather store, you know, because they've tanned the hides. And then you have a fertilizer store because they've taken the innards and they've dried them and made the fertilizer. And then you also have a dog food and cat food because they could use some of the parts that are not fit for human consumption making dog food, all in one complex, see? Utilizing it, you know, multitasking. I'm just, you know, thinking about what are the possibilities here? Anyway, we will have the responsibility to accomplish the following. Let's go to Isaiah 2 and verse 4. Isaiah 2:4, it says, he shall judge between the nations and rebuke many peoples. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. So people learn to hate and they learn war. And once you unlearn them, hey, you can do many wonderful things. In modern terms, we will turn tanks into tractors, battleships and planes into useful farm implements, and dismantle the missiles and the silos across the world, recycle them. And, you know, I was thinking of this. Across the United States, you've got these huge silos, right? They're all encased in cement. And well, you go in there, you know, you dismantle all the metal part, and you can just use the cement part for a well. I mean, it's deep enough. It's not going to pollute nothing. I mean, they line wells with cement today. Hey, got a bunch of wells instead of, you know, rockets coming up to kill people. The task is enormous, and it won't be done in one day. But some time in the future, the land will be pollution-free with pristine rivers and lakes where you can catch fish with two eyes and not three. And it won't be full of worms. I mean, you know, it's unbelievable the pollution that we have today. But here again, the problem will be solved, and it will be our responsibility. The third area is the air. Now, the two biggest pollutants of the air is the internal combustion engine, and I said that correctly, internal combustion engine, and industrial waste, which are sent into the air. Now, in my mind, the engine is not that big a deal because, you know, there are several ways to go. There are limitations to going to solar power for vehicles, like that's just the nature of the beast. But you could have an engine that converts water into oxygen and hydrogen burns totally clean, no residue, and that would give you enough power if you need the power, the horsepower, to accomplish the task at hand, and it'd be totally pollution free. So you know, you just run on water. You know, you could have a 10-mile electric cord to your electric car. Of course, it limits you for how far you can go. But here again, you know, these problems have to be dealt with, and they will be dealt with once you apply the brains, you know, to peaceful uses instead of, you know, doing what they're doing today. Like I said earlier, after the aftermath of the tribulation, I don't see many industries still functioning personally. Those are do not produce useful things are going to be shut down, and we're still going to need clothing, furniture, other things that people use because we're still going to be a user society. I mean, you still have clothes on your back and food on your plate, but these huge chemicals factories and you know that are and these genetically modified things. I mean, it's just horrendous. That's going to be all put to an end. New plants will be engineered to be totally eco-friendly and non-polluting and as far as the atmosphere and water supply. Like industry, there are ways, you know, like to clean up the products of industry, clean up the air so you don't pollute the air. So the air eventually has to be cleaned up. And here again, too, once you stop polluting, it's amazing, you know, how great it will be. You know, it'll add new meaning to a breath of fresh air. It will really be fresh. I mean, you know, today, or on the way down, it was natural cause, but still, you know, there's fires up there in Washington near Wenatchee. I mean, it was almost like a fog, and driving through it, and of course, it gets in your car, and you know, it's a form of pollution, but still, the air will eventually be clean. And now the fourth area is the final frontier, space. You didn't think of that one, did you? Space debris, also known as orbital debris, space junk, space waste, is the collection of objects in orbit around the Earth that were created by humans with no longer serve and useful purposes. These objects consist of everything from spent rocket stages to defunct satellites to erosion, explosion, and collision fragments, as the orbits of these objects often overlapped in trajectories of newer objects, debris, in a potential collision risk to operational spacecraft. The majority of the estimated tens of millions of pieces of space debris are small particles less than 1 centimeter. Tens of millions. Okay? These include dust and solid rocket motors, surface degradation products such as paint flakes, and coolant release from RORSAT, whatever that is, nuclear-powered satellites. Impacts of these particular cause erosive damage similar to sandblasting. This damage can be partially mitigated through the use of the meteor bumper, which is widely used on spacecraft such as the International Space Station. However, not all parts of a spacecraft may be protected this manner. Solar panels and optical devices such as telescopes and star trackers. And these components are subject to constant wear by debris to much extent. I mean, you know, there's tens of millions of space junk out there. I mean, you know, you don't want to be sitting peacefully in the millennium, you know, asking the blessing on the meal, and all of a sudden a piece of space junk comes crashing through your living room. You know, oh, maybe we should have dealt with that. My neighbor down the street, they were building a subdivision. Some of you have been to our house, but there's a bit of a mountain on the other side, and they built a subdivision in there, and they were blasting away. And I guess the blaster put a little bit too much dynamite, and she's sitting in her living room, and all of a sudden, kaboom, through her roof, through her ceiling, a rock about this big, about 20 inches in diameter, comes crashing through about 8 feet away and right through the floor. I mean, a hole through all three of them. And it almost gave her a heart attack. And, of course, you know, the blaster and the engineer, and they were all down there apologizing. But that would have been little help if she'd have been closer to the impact. But, I mean, you can't leave this space junk up there. It's got to be dealt with. Now, how is this going to be done? Now, that's a tricky part, eh? You get a big net up there, see? I don't really know. I mean, I thought, okay, how could it be dealt with? I mean, as a possibility. One way, and this is only one way that I thought of, and I'm not a rocket scientist by any measure of the imagination, would be to build a big net, and you shoot the particles of space negatively, and you have the net positively, so that they attract each other like a magnet, and you hang this thing out in space so that when these particles come by, I'd be attracted to it. Hey, big vacuum cleaner? I don't know. But the thing is, if they could put a man on the moon, they can put their minds together and say, let's get rid of this space junk. Because I can't see during the millennium using that type of... I mean, what's it for? Spy purposes. I mean, sure, it is for telecommunications to some degree, but it's mostly for spying, you know, and for war purposes and stuff up there. But I'm sure they'll come up with technology where that's not required, because anything up in space, eventually it loses its orbit, and eventually it's going to come crashing through the atmosphere, and that's just unacceptable in the millennium. So, here again, folks, we have to deal with that. That's another problem that has to be dealt with. Has to be cleaned up. So today we've looked at some of the challenges that we'll face at the onset of the millennium and into the millennium, and I can imagine and I know for several years we have looked at the challenges in regards to the pollution in the oceans, pollutions on the land, pollutions in the air, and also pollutions in space. Now these are areas that have to be cleaned up to make the world safe environmentally and a pleasant place to live where you can raise a family and for the human race. Well, how important is it really? I'd like you to turn to Romans 8 and we'll read this scripture and then you could just think about this for a bit. In Romans 8, in verse 16 it says, "The Spirit himself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. And if children, then heirs of God, and joint heirs with Christ, if indeed we suffer with him, that we may also be glorified together." Now that's our potential, brethren, to be glorified sons of God, right? "For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed in us." So he's saying, I mean, you read about the things he went through. He suffered a lot physically, but he says that's nothing compared to the reward out there. "For the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly awaits for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subject to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope. Because the creation itself will also be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God." It'll be delivered from this corruption of pollution of the air, the water, the space. "For we know that the whole creation groans." I mean, the earth is just groaning. Like, you know, if you put your hand in a vise and start, you know, you're groaning with pain. That's how the earth is groaning with all this pollution that man is doing to it. "And the labors, and labors with birth pangs together until now." It's almost like in labor pains, you know, there's got to be a solution to this problem. "Not only that, but we also who have the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, eagerly waiting for the adoption, the redemption of our body." So it's like us too, we're just sort of aching, anxious to get this new body. I mean, one with hair and all my teeth. But you know, you can just picture the earth is groaning because of what man's doing to it, and we're in the same position groaning to be sons of God so we can help the earth recover. So you can see, brethren, the whole creation is waiting for you as sons of God to be engaged in the solution to worldwide pollution. Just one of the many responsibilities and tasks we'll be involved in during the millennium, which this week pictures. So it's really something to look forward to, brethren. Problem, solution. There's the problem. We have the solution.